Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me this week for a special Tuesday edition of the Roundtable, we have Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Hey, great to be here.
And Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Haley.
Happy Tuesday.
And the Ohio Capital Journal reporter, Megan Henry. Welcome back, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And yes, it is Tuesday. We keep reminding ourselves it is Tuesday, not Monday. An effort to overturn a new marijuana law hit a snag last week. Haley, why did Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost reject this referendum petition? The group is called Ohioans for Cannabis Choice.
Yeah, so he said some of the language in the petition that they submitted was inaccurate and therefore could mislead voters. He pointed to a few examples. In one case, there were two different definitions of hemp in the language. He also said that there was a reference to Ohioans losing the ability to have cannabis delivered to them, and said that that's not explicitly laid out in the current marijuana law. So just technical stuff like that. We see this a lot in this stage of petitions, whether it's a constitutional amendment or referendum like this, you know, Yost's office and then eventually Secretary of State Frank LaRose's office, you know, they drill down on this language and, you know, make sure that it follows what they perceive as the law.
And so, Megan, is it back to the drawing board? Did the group say they're going to try again?
Yeah, kind of. So, yeah, the group did say they're going to try again. So what they'll do now is they can go back and have an opportunity to fix the language, fix what Yost said were issues with the language, and they'll have to collect 1,000 signatures again to resubmit and go through the process again, and then Yost can approve the language or he can reject it like he did last week.
And Jeremy, the law takes effect in March, 90 days after DeWine signed it. It changes recreational marijuana, restricts intoxicating hemp products. But what does the referendum, what do they want to do, the referendum backers?
It would repeal parts of it, would not repeal the entire law. Mm-hmm. It would mainly repeal things dealing with hemp. Mm-hmm. It would specifically, one of the many things that this bill would do would stop the sale of most hemp THC beverages that are commonly available now and mm-hmm. ever from gas stations to bars. And so it would repeal parts of that. And so that's why these proponents of the law or opponents, have just 90 days because they have to collect the signatures before the law goes into effect. Now, one thing that, so some of the things that Dave Yost brought up here seem, you know, reasonable on the face of it. It seemed, you know, there are, the part of the language that he cited was, in the description, was something that Mike DeWine had vetoed out of the bill. So that makes sense. Like,
don't put it in there. It's not in there.
Mm-hmm. But I would say that the people seeking this referendum didn't have a whole lot of time to draw this up after they passed it. So they had to go through all these things and they found some mistakes. And one thing that caught my eye was in this letter by Dave Yost explaining this to the people seeking the referendum. He said, the above instances are a few examples of the omissions and misstatements, and further review will be undertaken. So he's like, well, I didn't even read all of it. I just, you know, I kind of looked and I found enough, and so I'm done. But it had strong hints of when prosecutors charge someone on one charge. So if they lose that, then they can go back and charge them with the other stuff. So this might not be the end of it.
So, Haley, what do they want to do? They want to stop the law from going into effect. That's what they want to do with this? Or can they change the law that lawmakers passed?
Yeah. So the way that this will work, if they are able to get their petition approved, is that the law passed by the legislature would go on the ballot before voters, and then voters would have the opportunity to decide whether they wanted this law to go into effect or not, which opponents of Senate Bill 56 feel like if they can get it to the ballot, the odds are in their favor, because as we all know, the recreational marijuana program was initially approved as a ballot measure, approved by the voters pretty overwhelmingly. So that is the eventual goal. You know, we've seen this before with the big union bill under Kasich. I can't remember what the bill number.
Senate Bill 5.
Yeah. So, you know, this is another tactic that citizens have to challenge what the legislature does.
So if they succeed, they rewrite it and Dave Yost lets it pass and Frank LaRose lets it pass. Are we talking May ballot or November?
November, I believe.
Okay. So it would pause the law from going into effect in March and wait for the voters to vote. Got it. And Megan, marijuana industry leaders who pushed for hemp regulation opposed this referendum, right?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. So the cannabis community in Ohio is kind of divided depending on what camp organization you're with. So there's this group called the Ohio Cannabis Coalition, and they condemn the referendum efforts. They say that they are, you know, not necessary, and that this quote will reopen the door to a Wild West marketplace of unregulated intoxicants. So kind of divided there within the cannabis community. And I will also add that it is, yeah, as Haley mentioned, it's been a while since a referendum has passed in Ohio. I believe it was 2011, the last time a referendum.
Senate Bill 5.
Yes, was overturned by the voters.
All right. Well, I guess we'll wait and see if they rewrite and what happens there. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. And we are talking with Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal, and Haley B. Miller from the Columbus Dispatch. In Minneapolis, protests over ICE activity intensified following the shooting of Renee Good more than a week ago. Another ICE officer shot and wounded a man there last week. President Trump now threatens to impose the Insurrection Act that would allow him to send the military to stop the protests. Here in Columbus, there are no signs of increased immigration enforcement, but ICE agents continue to detain people. Megan, do we know how many have been detained locally? Was there a count, or do they release numbers?
Yeah, it's kind of the big question. Is it's kind of like unclear, hard to determine like an exact count. We recently received a report from the Department of Homeland Security that back in December, during a week period during Operation Buckeye, more than 280 people were detained by ICE. I've talked to some folks here locally, and they've seen an uptick in ICE activity and folks being detained here recently, you know, averaging like, you know, 19 a day, but it's hard to get an exact count, even by people who are really boots on the ground trying to help people who are experiencing this, but it's kind of hard to get an exact number.
Right. There has been an uptick in ICE activity here in Columbus locally, but it's nothing compared to what we're seeing in Minnesota. The uptick
Correct.
Is like minor compared to that. Yes. U.S. Senator John Husted weighed in recently. Here's what he had to say.
You're free to speak out against ICE operations. You're free to help any individual who's been detained, but do not interject yourself into the process of law enforcement.
So, Jeremy, is he saying there anything different from what most Republicans are saying? What does he mean by don't inject yourself into the process?
I don't think John Husted's saying really anything different. it's very John Husted to preface it with the, hey, everyone still has free speech rights to protest it. But I think most Republicans and a lot of Democrats, too, are saying just don't get in the way. But I mean, I say most Democrats, but it's quickly becoming politicized, like most things are in this era, where you're having an increasing number of people on the left saying, no, you should stop it. You should hide people. You should resist and not do it. I mean, there was a bill in the legislature, in the Ohio legislature last year, that would forbid any public official from not helping ICE and other law enforcement officials, federal law enforcement officials, from doing their duty. Mm-hmm. So you can't obstruct it. So this is quickly becoming very politicized. And John Husted, of course, who's running for election this November, is certainly going to not say anything. Not that I don't believe that he truly believes it, but he's certainly not going to say anything that would be against that. Mm.
And Congresswoman Joyce Beatty condemned Operation Buckeye. She wrote a letter to the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, and in it she said that agents are racially targeting people. Haley, does someone like Congresswoman Beatty, does she have any power here? Can she do anything?
Likely not, because she's a Democrat in the minority in the House of Representatives right now. You know, Republicans control the White House. She, of course, has a responsibility to advocate on behalf of her district. And, you know, I think that's what this letter signals. But I don't think a letter from Representative Beatty is going to sway the Trump administration or DHS on what they do or do not do regarding immigration enforcement in Columbus.
Well, and then ICE related, ICE adjacent, but also politics related. Ohio native Madison, is it Sheehan? Is that how, or Sheehan? I'm not sure. Sheehan. She has the number two position at Immigration and Customs Enforcement until last week. So she is 28. She held that position for less than a year, and she resigned and decided last week to jump into politics, planning to run in Ohio's 9th congressional district as a Republican in the hopes of unseating Toledo's longtime Democratic Representative Marcy Kaptur. In her official announcement, she said that she's done more to stop illegal immigration in less than a year than Kaptur has done in 43 years in Washington. So, Jeremy, what do we know about her? And because I know that this seat is significant. I mean, this is going to be one of the most contested seats in the country. What do we know about her running against Marcy Kaptur here?
She's a political newcomer. Mm-hmm. She is someone who lived in the Columbus area until fairly recently. And it just shows how much these congressional elections are based on national issues as opposed to Ohio issues. The Republican campaign, the primary campaign for a Kaptur seat, is already the most interesting and competitive primary in Ohio, at least in terms of congressional races. You have State Representative Josh Williams, Derek Marin, who's a former lawmaker who lost to Kaptur by only a few thousand votes in 2024. You have a few other candidates already in the race, and that's even before Madison joined the race. I think her entry shows that there are many Republicans, prominent Republicans, who feel that this race would not be winnable by the candidates who are already in the race. Whether that's true or not, I guess we'll find out. Even in a seat, even a district that was recently redrawn to be even more favorable to Republicans. The question now is whether that will actually catch fire with Republican voters, that someone who's new to politics, which hasn't been exactly a problem in the past few cycles for candidates, but someone who is fairly new to the district, too, will be able to win.
Yeah. Haley, what do you make of this? The deputy director of ICE jumping into this congressional race that already had plenty of Republicans running in it. So it's not like they were looking for a candidate.
Yeah, it is an interesting twist. As Jeremy noted, this primary was already pretty interesting and poised to be a little messy, and I think it's just going to get messier now. Madison did grow up in the district. Her family's from Ottawa County, but she's, you know, lived in the Columbus area. She went to Ohio State. She worked in Louisiana for the state government there for a while, then was working for ICE. You know, she's 28, so I think like most people in their 20s, she's bounced around a lot recently. So I'll be curious to see whether that is relevant to voters at all. You know, while she did grow up in the district, she hasn't been there lately. You know, if people care much about that, or if they see the fact that she worked for ICE and that resonates. You know, primary voters are often very different from general election voters. So, you know, whoever wins the primary will obviously have to face Kaptur, and, you know, Republicans are going to want to make sure they have a candidate that can not only win the primary, but can beat Kaptur.
And Megan, do you feel like Marcy Kaptur's campaign is probably just sitting back and waiting with, you know, if there's four or five Republicans, I don't know that it matters to them to be too vocal about any one in particular.
Correct. Yeah, it seems like they're kind of just sitting back for now until the primary happens in May and seeing, you know, who Kaptur will end up facing in November.
Yeah. And Jeremy, this seat is said to be one of the most highly contested in the country. I mean, well, you know, eventually when we get to November, will all eyes be on Toledo?
Well, it's one of only, I think, about 10 or 12 districts in the country that voted for Donald Trump in 2024, but is currently represented by a Democratic member of Congress. So there's not a lot of these swing districts left, especially with the recent spat of redistricting, where seats have become either solidly Democratic or solidly Republican. This is a district that is actually up for grabs, especially with Marcy Kaptur. It'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, if you're a Republican, you might be very tempted to say, well, I'm going to sit this one out. And when Marcy Kaptur actually does end up leaving, which, you know, could be any term now, is the thinking, then why not just wait? And then when it's an open seat, go for it, because there's no obvious Democratic heir apparent for Kaptur in that district. But you have a bunch of people who are, you know, there's not a lot of these districts left that are competitive, and so they're all going for it right now.
Do we know where Madison Sheehan came from? Like, was the plan to put her in this deputy director spot for ICE so that she could run for Congress eventually? Or do it like, is that speculating too much? I don't know where, you said she went to Ohio State and then she, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this came out of left field to me. I okay. certainly wasn't expecting another candidate to enter this race, but I've been wrong before.
I don't think it was calculated like, well, I'm going to go to Louisiana and then I'm going to go. But I think Kristi Noem has a number of political advisors with connections to Ohio. Mm-hmm. You have the success group. The strategy group, excuse me. And then you have a number of people with prominent Republicans with connection to Kristi Noem. And so if you have Noem's number two, that makes sense that they would, when looking around, she would be on their radar.
And in the redistricting that you mentioned, they redrew this district that Marcy Kaptur is in theory, to be more red, correct?
More red and more favorable to Rob McCauley, the Senate president, who many people expected was going to run for Congress. And then, of course, he ended up becoming Vivek Ramaswamy's running mate now. So, you know, it was redrawn to help McCauley. And the counties that were added, more rural counties like Putnam County and Williams County, these are districts that they don't really know Derek Maron. They don't really know Josh Williams. So they're sort of up for grabs.
And McCauley, he's from Napoleon, which is up in Northwest Ohio. So does his district now include, would that be under
Kaptur? It includes parts of McCauley's existing district, but that's a state Senate district. And so it was drawn to help McCauley, but now McCauley's not running. And these are districts where it's basically, these are counties where it's basically illegal to be a Democrat. These are places where Democrats usually get about 20% of the vote. So it's, but they're not that, with the exception of Putnam, not that numerous. So there's a bunch of Republican votes there, but not that many. But if one person can kind of get a landslide in that primary, then that can make the difference.
Did you have something to add?
No, I was just saying, to speculate for a second, you know, Jeremy brings up a good point with McCauley. I think, you know, if Madison's entry into the race means anything, it's that, you know, it obviously happened after McCauley decided he wasn't going to run for Congress because he's going to be on Vivek Ramaswamy's ticket. So part of me wonders if someone's looking at some polling somewhere and not seeing what they like with, you know, Williams and Maron and how they could potentially match up against Kaptur.
Okay. So now that McCauley's out, they thought there was room for her to step in. Okay. Well, coming up, we are going to talk about daycare legislation, the first energy trial, and some trouble with security guards. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me this week on a special Tuesday edition of the Reporter Roundtable, we have Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Ohio Capital Journal reporter Megan Henry, and chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Jeremy Pelzer. So recently, Republican candidate for governor Vivek Ramaswamy fired the firm that he was using for his campaign security. This was after one of his guards was arrested on federal drug trafficking charges. But then Jeremy, Cleveland.com found that at least two of the guards working for Ramaswamy were not registered with the state. So I did not even know security guards needed to register with the state. That was new information for me. So can you tell us more about what's going on here? What does it mean to not be registered with the state?
Nor did I until looking into this article, which I should give credit to blogger DJ Burns, a.k.a. The Rooster, for first reporting. But so Ramaswamy's had this firm called Arc Protection Group since at least 2024. And they've been very high profile. Like, they have an Instagram posting pictures of themselves on social media, not just Instagram, you know, Facebook too. And they drew added scrutiny as you said, in late December, one of the protection detail members named Justin Salisbury, he got arrested, he and his wife, on federal drug trafficking charges. But under state law, you have to be registered to be a security guard or a bodyguard or any private security personnel. And that, so the company has to register, and then they will have all their employees register. And there's pretty steep penalties if you don't do this. It could mean jail time for both you and your employer. It could be criminal fines. And then there's an added civil fine of up to $100 per day for a violation for both the employee and the employer. So there's a pretty steep penalty here. There were at least two personnel that I found just looking at the Instagram account of Arc Protection Group, which is based near Worcester, that I found where they were clearly there. If you look at the pictures, clearly there as in a security, like one of them was wearing like a Arc Protection Group hat. One of them, the caption actually said, you know, talked about the guy being in a protection detail, but he hadn't been registered with the state since 2024. Mm. And there was another guy named Jacob Owens, who was never registered with the state.
That seems like a lot of days if they've been working for the campaign for over a year.
Well, I don't. I mean, we'll see how long they've been working. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that the state is looking into this, mm-hmm. The State Department of Homeland Security. So none of this is to say that necessarily Vivek Ramaswamy was aware of this or condoned it. When I asked his spokeswoman whether he vetted this company or vetted the people, she didn't really give a direct answer except to say that he is letting go, as you said, firing this firm.
Now, when you say the employer could be fined, is the employer Arc Security or Ramaswamy's campaign?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, mm-hmm. the security firm. So okay. Vivek is not on the
hook here. Okay.
Because theoretically, he is the victim here, because if you have unregistered, unlicensed security and they portray themselves as such to the client, well, you're getting unregistered security. So there's nothing in law saying that the customers of these security firms, they can't get, they're not on the hook for anything. It's really just the firms themselves.
So he trusted the security firm to be on the up and up, right?
And yeah. And we don't know what went into there, if the security firm was just dishonest, or, you know, I would say it's more likely that, you know, because the owner,
they didn't know either. You and I didn't know you had to register. They didn't know either.
And the owner and the security firm themselves are registered with the state. It's just the members, the security guards that they hired, they were, at least a couple of them were not registered. So it's understandable if that's what happened.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. But there's also a trust issue here. I mean, candidates are very close with security detail. As you say, they're close enough to be in the pictures. And these people are working to protect his family, too. Did the campaign say anything, any indications of regret? These people worked very closely with them.
Definitely regret. And they said that they were alarmed, especially when asked about this guy who's now facing federal drug trafficking charges, who protected Ramaswamy's family. Like, they had no indication that was going on. It's not like there's no allegations that the guy was dealing, you know, trafficking drugs while protecting Ramaswamy's family. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think just about anyone would be troubled if they had a security protection and they were now accused of a federal drug drug crime, excuse me.
Yeah, and we should say that the federal part of the drug crime is because they were using the U.S. Postal Service, what made it federal. Yeah,
yeah, they received, according to the allegations, about 260 parcels of drugs, and then they would either mail those on to customers or put them in a cooler outside on their porch in Bell Fountain, and then customers would come and pick them up.
Oh, like a pickup, like a buy-sell-trade pickup. Oh.
Right, yeah.
All right. Anyway, I guess we will just see what happens with that. And I'm sure that you said the state would be the ones to look into this, the State Department of Homeland.
Yeah, Public Safety, and underneath that is Ohio Department of Homeland Security.
Okay, so they're the ones that, like, keep records of security guards being registered.
Yeah, and I talked to the trade group that represents the security sector, and they actually, according to this guy, they send investigators out even to, like, public events to see, and they'll challenge, go up to security detail members and say, hey, where's your ID card? Because if you're registered, you get an ID card. And they'll actually challenge people at public events where they know there will be security and say, hey, I need to see your ID card. I don't think that happened in this case, but apparently that happens.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about state politics with Jeremy Pelzer with Cleveland.com, Megan Henry with the Ohio Capital Journal, and Haley B. Miller from the Columbus Dispatch. There's been a lot of talk about child care fraud in Minnesota, and that has trickled down to Ohio as well. Governor DeWine said recently that cases of fraud are rare, and safeguards are in place in Ohio to spot it when it occurs. Last week, Republican lawmakers proposed two separate bills meant to crack down on fraud and give more authority to Attorney General Dave Yost. So, Megan, can you remind us of where these allegations are coming from? Has anyone provided concrete evidence of fraud in Ohio, let alone the idea of calling it widespread fraud?
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, this is following child care fraud allegations in Minnesota that originated in Minnesota, that is, by right-wing social media influencer. And that's in part because of Minnesota is such a the largest Somali population in the United States, and Columbus is the second largest Somali population in the United States. And so after these Minnesota allegations, then similar allegations were made in Ohio, but they were not really rooted in anything concrete or specific, or no specific instances, that is. And so just kind of spread like wildfire after the holiday season. And that's kind of how we got to where we are today in Ohio with these allegations of child care fraud.
And Haley, there's two childcare proposals that I mentioned. So there's two different bills in the pipeline. One of the bills comes from Representative DJ Swearingen and Republican Representative Josh Williams. Williams says he believes cases of fraud are being, quote, swept under the rug. And he said he received a number of tips that indicated more fraud in the state than it's being found. Did he have evidence for that? Or like, what is he saying?
So he referenced some numbers that Governor Mike DeWine also referenced during his press conference on this issue a couple weeks ago. DeWine had said that, I believe, 38 daycares were closed in 2025 after investigations. And, you know, Williams said that, you know, there had been 38 daycares closed since, you know, these, quote, citizen journalists started uncovering all these allegations. So a little bit of a misrepresentation of the numbers there. But his bill, there's some overlap with his bill and the other piece of legislation that was introduced. But, you know, they want to install cameras in public areas at these publicly funded daycares and change the way that daycares verify attendance, you know, things like that. Williams has been really outspoken and in front of this issue since the claims first surfaced. You know, he's been kind of leading the charge. There's been a lot of stuff that we've seen from him on social media about this.
Is this the same Williams we just mentioned is running for Congress?
Yes.
Okay. Just clarifying. Okay. And then a DeWine spokesperson told Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau for a story that Williams is mistaken in how he's interpreting the data. So is that what you meant by?
Yeah. Yeah. He misunderstood. He either misunderstood or misrepresented the numbers that came from the DeWine administration. So, you know, again, It's interesting. The other piece of legislation that was introduced at that press conference, lawmakers were joined by the director of Ohio Children and Youth Services. So I think the DeWine administration is making clear which bill they would prefer to see make through the legislature.
So the other bill is from Republican Representatives Phil Plummer and Tom Young. Here is Young outlining what the bill won't do.
The thing that this bill doesn't do, it doesn't reduce eligibilities for families currently receiving care. It does not eliminate transitional child care. It does not target providers who are operating safely and lawfully. And that's a very, very key point.
Okay, so what does the bill do? Though he just outlined what it doesn't do.
Right. It would allow the Ohio Attorney General to investigate these child care providers. It would allow Ohio Department of Children and Youth, they could suspend a provider's license without a hearing if they're suspected of fraud. And it would spend some money to on automated attendance reviews. So Representative Phil Plummer, who's also co-sponsoring this legislation, you know, he cast this as trying to stay a step ahead of the game and close gaps. But, you know, he said this is under control in Ohio, which is obviously a very different position than we were hearing from Williams.
And if I'm thinking of the right story, you talked with the director of the child care center called 161 Child Care in Columbus's Northland neighborhood. Is that right?
My colleague did.
Colleague did. Okay. Do you remember what they found out about? Because that's one of the daycares that had like a viral video made about them where someone with a video camera basically went to the daycare when the daycare was closed and said that it was didn't have any children at it, but it was closed for the holidays. Do you have any further information on what your colleague found?
Yeah, our understanding is that the claims, I can't remember the specifics, but that the claims on social media about that particular facility have been refuted. And, you know, the owners of that facility, as with a lot of other child care providers, especially in the Somali community, are really shaken up, really on edge right now. You know, a lot of families have questioned whether they should even send their kids to daycare right now. So a lot of just uneasiness and uncertainty.
Mainly families in the Somali communities at these daycares that are being targeted. Yeah. Then there's also the added issue of federal funding. Child care advocates are worried. Ohio receives $443 million in federal funding with federal child care subsidies. And Linan Gutierrez works at Groundwork Ohio, an early childhood advocacy group. She spoke to the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau about her concerns.
We certainly don't want to see any disruption in services that would disrupt both the program and the ability for those children and families who are working and that child that needs that steady, consistent care to not be able to access that care when they need it.
So, Megan, last week we talked about how the state of Ohio pays the minimum required when it comes to matching federal child care funding, but losing federal funding in any way would have a big impact. Do you know is the state prepared to step up and pay more for child care, or is it going to be what it is right now?
That's a good question. I honestly have not done much reporting on this, Jeremy or Haley.
So the state is looking through to do many things because over the past few years, daycare has become a major, major issue, especially by business groups now who are saying that this is a hindrance to job creation, because as companies look for people to fill these jobs, a lot of people can't find childcare, or it's not either not accessible or it's too expensive or both. And so the state is trying to do many things to encourage daycare. One of the things that they're looking at now, for example, would split the cost. It would be a program to split the cost of daycare between, it would be shared between the employer, the state, and the parents would each kick in a percentage of money. And so this has become a big issue already in Ohio. And then coincidentally, here comes this federal, this more nationalized issue of Somali daycares, where it started in Minnesota. And the argument seems to be, well, there's Somalis in Minnesota, there's Somalis in Ohio. Well, there must be fraud in Ohio because there's these reports of fraud in Minnesota. But it's already something that it's on lawmakers' radar in terms of increasing access and to childcare and making it more affordable.
All right. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on what lawmakers decide to do with daycares. And as Jeremy said, it predates all of these fraud allegations as well. They've been talking about it. Coming up, Governor DeWine weighs in on the basketball point shaving scandal. And also, we're going to talk about First Energy. They're back in the news and their trial is coming up. That is when the Reporter Roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And still with us for our special Tuesday edition of the Reporter Roundtable, we have Ohio Capital Journal reporter Megan Henry, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Haley B. Miller, and chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Jeremy Pelzer. I wanted to talk about First Energy because they're back in the news. A trial is coming up and consumers will get some money back. This is nearly 7 years after the House Bill 6 passed. Jeremy, are you able to catch us up on this? Or will customers could start seeing money as early as February 1st? Mm-hmm. What kind of money are we talking about here?
So if you are a residential customer for First Energy, so illuminating company, Toledo Edison or Ohio Edison, you use about 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity every month. Over the next three billing periods, you'll see a total of about $65.61.
$65.
$65 total off your bill.
Oh, be still my heart. Okay, sorry. Continue.
It's something. And then in addition to that, that all told is about $250 million in refunds.
Yeah.
Then you get another $20 million from First Energy for low-income customer programs. On top of that, total of $6.6 million, another refund for improper charges. And then you get $5 million to this trade group for retail energy for corporate separation violations. So all this is a settlement agreement that First Energy reached to resolve these four state investigations that were launched after Larry Householder, the former Speaker of the House, got arrested. Mm-hmm. So these are investigations into House Bill 6 over various alleged violations that First Energy did in terms of using money, ratepayer money for lobbying, which you're not allowed to do. These corporate separations where various parts of the company were propping up other parts in a way that you can't do. And so this First Energy just said, okay, well, let's put all this to bed. We'll pay this amount and we'll just resolve all these in one fell swoop.
And I was just going to ask what took so long, but that's what took so long, negotiating that and all the trials. And
well, first they put this on hold because there was a federal case against Householder. So yeah, they put it on hold for that. Then they had these lengthy testimony by a number of people involved in it who used to work for First Energy. And then there was that at last spring. And then finally, the PUCO, the Public Utilities Commission that regulates utilities, came out with an initial round of fines. But then they had this one part of the case that didn't get resolved. So First Energy said, okay, let's just settle all of it. And this is what they reached.
The trial that I mentioned is going to start on Monday, the 26th. Two former executives, ex-CEO Chuck Jones and former lobbyist Mike Dowling. So it's scheduled to begin on Monday. Do we know what charges they are facing? Do you know?
I don't. They're facing a whole bunch of charges.
All the things. All right.
Yeah, they're facing bribery, the state equivalent of RICO, basically, that they had an organized conspiracy. A lot of different stuff.
Okay.
And so they could be in serious trouble if they get convicted. Now, there's no guarantee that they will get convicted. That's going to all come out at trial. So we're going to see starting January 26th, which you'll likely start with picking the jury mm-hmm. and go from there.
And the witness list includes Governor DeWine and U.S. Senator John Husted. Can we speculate? Do we know, Haley, if they will actually be called? Will they testify? What'll happen there?
It's hard to say at this point. You know, we've seen their names on witness lists in the past, along with some other high-profile folks in Ohio. So it's, you know, I'm not 100% sure what the likelihood of them actually testifying is. You know, I think we've seen their names come, Husted and DeWine's names come up a lot throughout the course of the House Bill 6 scandal, not because they have been charged with anything, because they haven't, but, you know, because they were in the governor's mansion at the time of this. And, you know, Husted has a lot of, you know, ties to, you know, business, things like that. So, I guess TBD.
We'll see. Yeah. And Jeremy, is this trial happening in Cleveland or here?
It's going to be in Akron because First Energy, their headquarters is in Akron. So mm-hmm. it's going to be in Summit County Court. And they're not the only witnesses. DeWine and Husted aren't the only potential witnesses that Jones and Dowling want to call. They want to call potentially Bill Seitz, who's a prominent former lawmaker, Michael Hall, who's the former chief of staff for Mike DeWine, a number of former First Energy officials. Really what Jones and Dowling, what they want to establish was, hey, this wasn't on us. This was on First Energy, the company. So we aren't guilty of this. So they're going to argue that, as well as these were legal campaign donations that were basically free speech. So we are being now vilified and prosecuted for what's essentially free speech.
So the CEO, the person, is saying he's not the company?
That it was done, that the company did it. I didn't do it. And we'll see in the trial exactly how they make that argument.
Will we hear from Householder, do you think?
He's in prison.
Yeah.
Householder's in prison, so you will not likely hear from Householder.
Okay.
Unless Trump gives him a pardon or something. But and all of this is contingent on, you know, if they admit certain evidence, and then what they're not going to just call DeWine or Husted just for the sake of calling him. It's going to be in furtherance of certain arguments they're trying to make, and we'll see what those arguments are.
Well, for the future made-for-TV movie, I think that DeWine and Husted would be, you know, if they were called, that'll make the TV movie a little bit better. All right, we'll see. Moving on, Governor DeWine put out a statement following the indictment of 20 people in a college basketball points-shaving scandal last week. It involved 39 players in 17 schools. Two of the games that were being investigated were played in Ohio. One was played at Kent State. One was played at Ohio University. Has anyone been following this, or did anyone catch up with this whenever it broke last week? Or we could just talk about how DeWine doesn't like sports betting in general.
Yeah, I haven't followed this in detail, but his statement didn't surprise me because, to your point, he's been really frustrated with the sports gambling environment and how it's affected Ohio. I mean, we've seen players being targeted because, you know, people aren't happy with the outcome of a game. So he's been, you know, really trying to rein in the sports betting universe. And, you know, to him, I think this was just another example of how the sports gambling industry, so to speak, has just gotten out of control.
And Megan, DeWine has said in the past that he regrets legalizing sports gambling, but it's hard to put that genie back in the bottle. Is there any more Ohio plans to do when it comes to restricting gambling?
Yeah, as you mentioned, yeah, DeWine is not a fan of sports gambling. That would have to be some of the lawmakers have to take up. But it does remind me how back in the summer, back in August, DeWine said he made a proclamation that he wants to get rid of prop betting after two Cleveland Guardians players were placed on leave for gambling allegations. So he called on the Ohio Casino Control Commission to remove prop betting. But that would have to there had to be action taken up by the commission or lawmakers to really make any changes.
He asked them to do that months ago. It didn't happen yet, or is it not that quick of a process?
So what happened is DeWine has been really at kind of at the forefront mm-hmm. of restricting, especially something called microprop bets, which is instead
each individual pitch. Yeah.
So it's not, and it's seen as more dangerous because instead of doing something like point shaving or throwing an entire game, mm-hmm. These are bets on like the first pitch of the third inning will be a ball or a strike. And so if you're a player, you're like, well, that's not going to cost my team a game if I just throw one ball. Mm-hmm. And so it's seen as more kind of dangerous because it's more, people are more likely to do it. And so he's, the way DeWine's done it as Megan and Haley have said, is not to seek additional legislation, but to right now in the existing law, the easiest way to get a ban on the form of betting is to actually have the leagues do it. As opposed to have regulators do it. So
DeWine, say Major League Baseball do it.
So that DeWine actually talked with the commissioner of baseball and said, hey, you guys really should do this. And indeed they did it. But they're not doing it all at once because they want to wait till after the seasons are over. So they don't want to change the betting rules mid-season. So after the baseball season ended, you saw baseball. And I bet now that the NFL season ends, you'll probably see the NFL come out and actually seek restrictions on micro prop bets and prop bets. So there's, especially in the legislature, there's hesitancy to ban prop bets. Things like, this player will hit two home runs in a game. Mm. And so I think you'll see a movement to ban these micro prop bets, which were at the center, as Megan said, of this Guardian scandal, but maybe not anything else.
Mm. All right. Speaking of sports, though, Jeremy, I wanted to just have you weigh in. A judge's temporary ruling prevents Ohio from using $600 million in unclaimed funds for the Browns Stadium. But I did see a release of the stadium moving forward. Is it moving forward? What's happening?
So Brook Park earlier this month issued permits to do $65 million in renovate excavation work, basically to dig
a hole. That's what I saw, the permits, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they have to sink the stadium down so it doesn't interfere with air traffic from Cleveland Hopkins International Airport, which is kind of next door.
Okay.
Now, the question here is, will this court injunction, this temporary move, interrupt the work? The plan was to start work on the stadium kind of now in order to own it, in order to open it in time for the 2029 NFL season. And my colleague Rich Exner actually had something over the weekend that it's really up to the Browns owners, Jimmy and Dee Haslam, to decide if they want to pony up the money that while the $600 million is up in the air from the state, if they want to take out more loans or put up their own money to make sure that this work gets started now. Because the Browns, local officials, state officials, they all said, no, don't worry. You know, even if there's an injunction, a longer injunction issued, which is what we're waiting to see now, because right now it's on hold just until they decide on an injunction. But even if they say, yeah, we're going to hold up all this money until the trial next year, they're all saying, no, this won't interrupt anything. Hmm. But then when you kind of push them on it, no one really knows. And it's going to really be up to the Haslams to decide if they want to put up the money needed to make sure that this work goes forward starting now.
So they have the permits to dig the hole.
They have the permits to dig the hole.
But the Haslams haven't said, go dig the hole.
There's no hole yet. And so they have to decide what they want to, you know, put up the money to dig a really big hole next to the airport.
There's some sort of joke there about the Browns and digging a hole, but right, yeah, okay, I'll leave it there.
You have to dig themselves out of the hole. Yeah.
Thank you for that. Yes, exactly. There it is. Megan, we only have 2 minutes left, but you wrote recently about the status of some education bills, and one we haven't talked about on the show in a while is the display of the Ten Commandments in public schools. Can you remind us about this or tell us what is happening with this one?
Sure, yeah. So this bill, it's a Senate bill. It passed in the Senate before the holidays, and basically the bill would require public schools to display historical text in the classroom, and schools would be able to pick from a list, and the list includes the Ten Commandments as well as other documents such as the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence. They have to pick four documents, that is. So they don't have to pick Ten Commandments, but that is on the list of documents that they could choose from.
Okay, and so this bill passed the Senate, you said, but has the House even taken it up?
I don't believe so. No, I think they went on break right after. I think both chambers went on break right after this passed. So the House will pick it up when the lawmakers return.
Is this something that has been seen as having legs, like actually happening? I don't know if anyone's asked the governor about it or asked the House or anything.
I'm not totally sure, yeah, what the governor thinks of it, but it passed, you know, fairly quickly in the Senate. So I could see this very well moving through the House quickly.
All right. And we have 30 seconds left. Is there anything, Haley or Jeremy, that you're covering this week that you wanted to preview? Anything going on this week, or is it a cold, boring week?
Some breaking news.
Oh.
The vice president's going to be in Toledo on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So.
Oh. I want what related to what? It didn't say. Just to for fun.
talking, I think, you know,
Tony Pacos.
Yeah.
It's hungry.
Touting the administration, I suppose.
Yeah. All right. Maybe, and maybe doing a little stumping for a congressional candidate we talked about earlier.
Yeah, perhaps. To say.
All right. Well, thank you to Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for joining us, Haley.
Good to be here.
Ohio Capital Journal reporter Megan Henry, thank you.
Thank you.
And chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Jeremy Pelzer. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Amy.
And this has been the Reporter Roundtable on a Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.